Indeed, welcome very much to this tonight's event, Cambridge University Chemical Society panel debate, which is entitled A Small Problem, The Bioethics of Nanotechnology. I am Noel Rutter. I'm going to be chairing this evening's event. We have an excellent panel of guests. I'll briefly introduce them now, then they'll each come forward and give a short presentation, and then we'll take questions and have an interactive debate. That's going to be the major part of what we do this evening. So first of all, can I introduce Dr. Alex Porter here. Alex is a lecturer at Imperial College and carries out research into the impact of synthetic nanoparticles on human health and the environment. Our second speaker will be Professor Anthony Seaton, who's over here. He's a former head of Department of Environment, the Department of Environmental and Occupational Medicine at Edinburgh University. Thirdly, we'll have Dr. John Roberts, seated down here. He's the head of Chemicals and Nanotechnologies at DEFRA, which is the Government Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. And finally, our fourth speaker will be Professor Geoffrey Hunt, who is Professor of Ethics at the University of Surrey and a researcher into nanotechnology and society. Before we address this question of this small problem and we discuss minimising the potential public health risks of nanomaterials, I thought we might kick off on a slightly more positive note. The reason why this discussion is so important is that these materials are becoming used much more widely, used in greater quantities in a different range, in different ranges of applications, which range from things like zinc oxide in sunscreen, small titanium oxide particles in coatings for self-cleaning windows, nanoparticles of silver to destroy bacteria, platinum catalysts for fuel cells to make fuel cell cars. However, some of the very properties which make these materials useful in those applications can also be the source of some concerns. For example, the very large surface area to volume ratio that's very important for a catalyst could become a potential concern just due to its enhanced interactivity with its environment, especially when one considers things like living human cells. I'd like to read a short excerpt from Scientific American earlier this year, which I found. Apologies for the poor grammar contained in it. It is Scientific American. Article reads from the start, plastic imbued with clay nanoparticles helps make Miller Brewing Company beer bottles less likely to break, as well as improves how long the brew lasts in storage. Simply H's toddler health nutritional drink mix includes 300 nanometer, 300 billionths of meter, iron particles, and a wide range of cooking and cleaning items now employ nano-sized silver particles to kill microbes. Yet the Washington DC-based environmental group Friends of the Earth reports that none of the more than 100 food or food-related products it identified that contain nanoparticles bears a warning label or has undergone safety testing by government agencies. Products created using nanotechnology have entered the food chain, says report author Ian Illuminato, Friends of the Earth's health and environmental lobbyist. Preliminary studies indicate there is a serious risk. We should know that it's safe before we put it in our food. Now, before I scare you any more, I'm going to hand over to our expert panellists tonight. So first of all, I'd like Alex to come down and speak for a moment.
Okay, so thanks a lot for inviting me to come and speak today. The title of my talk is Developments in Nanotechnology, so I'll give you an introduction to the subject and then lead on a little to the impacts on human health. So I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, but just for the background, so nanotechnology, the word nano comes from the Greek word dwarfos, which means dwarf. What is a nanometer? So a nanometer is about, if you think of an atom as 2 times 10, 2 angstroms large, it's about 5 atoms large. But in nanotechnology, we generally think of nanostructures as of the order of about one going up to about 100 nanometers in size. The interest in nanomaterials is vast. The government investment in this area is predicted to be about $180 billion US dollars in 2008. So why are they so interesting? So as Noel alluded to before, as you go to the nanoscale, the properties of materials change. So they have novel electronic mechanical, optical, and also catalytic activity. So the example that Noel gave with catalysis is that they have a large high surface to volume ratio, which makes them excellent in catalyst applications. So the kind of areas that you might see currently on the market where nanoparticles are being used, so catalysis, sports equipment, they're being used in composite materials to increase the strength of the tennis racket. Another example here is some face creams where nanoparticles are being used to stop aging, so an anti-aging cream products. So that's kind of where they're at the moment. Where are they going? So the three, I would say, biggest growth areas of nanotechnology at the moment. So first of all, in electronics, big area of growth is in plastic electronics, where they're being used as display technology. So in this application, the advantage is that they're cheap. They can be used on any substrate, and they have tunable functionality. They're also being used in solar, so there's wide interest in solar applications and also medical applications, and that's the area I work in, so I'll give you a little short introduction to applications of nanotechnology in medicine, which is relevant here because that's where they really would be in direct contact with the body. So there are three different applications of nanotechnology in medicine. So first in biomaterials, that's in implants, diagnostics, and also in targeted drug delivery. So I've put up three examples here. So first in diagnostics, nanomaterials are being used in biosensing. So it's this idea of a lab on a chip, where, for example, you could screen the blood from a patient rapidly and detect, for example, various biomarkers of cancer from the patient, and then you could have a very fast delivery of treatment, so rapidly going back to the patient. In biomaterials applications, we're trying to get away from the idea of having a big metal chunk as a hip replacement in the body and instead use the idea of biomimetics, where you mimic the structure of tissue of the nanoscale and then try and build up to the macroscale to engineer, for example, bone. And then finally, targeted drug delivery, which I'll describe as that's where the nanoparticles are being used in nanomedicine. So the reason that nanoparticles have received such attention in this area is really because of their size. So the size of the nanoparticles is very similar to that of cell organelles, and also the size of the ion channels in the plasma membrane of the cell. So the idea is that you could use a nanoparticle, as I've shown here, as a carrier to deliver a drug to the cell. So you would have targeted delivery of the nanoparticle containing that drug to the cell, as I've shown here, where the nanoparticle is targeting the plasma membrane of the cell. So the advantages of nanoparticles in this area here, so there we see, for example, a tumour cell, there's a nanoparticle there, so you would target the nanoparticle to the tumour and then release the drug. So with this here, we would have excellent controlled release of the drug and also accurate targeting, so smaller quantities of drug are needed, and that may reduce the side effects of the drug. We also see some examples here where nanoparticles are being used in diagnostics, so you could encapsulate, for example, an MRI active contrast agent inside the nanoparticle, target it, for example, to a tumour, and then you could actually image the tumour inside the body. The area that I've been working on up to now is on the carbon nanotubes. So these are these graphitic tubular structures of carbon. So I've shown you applications but they're also being used in medicine. So for example, they're being used as in tumour targeting, where you can functionalise the surface and target the tumour cell. But there's been concerns in the media that these class of nanoparticles and also other classes may be unsafe to the body. So this is the kind of hype that's coming up in the media at the moment, which I know Anthony will follow up on after this. So what is the concern with these smaller classes of nanoparticles? So if we look at the C60 and single nanotubes, the diameter of the particle is about 1 nanometer. So the concern might be, if you look at the cell here, the sizes of the order of the ion channels in the plasma membrane of the cell, so perhaps they could diffuse into the cell where they could interact with various cell organelles or even diffuse through the nuclear pore into the nucleus. But to see this, we need to develop techniques, again, in nanotechnology to try and image them within the cell. And this is what I've been doing. This is my research. So we're using imaging techniques, electron microscopy, I don't know if this could work, but to actually image the nanoparticles in the cell, first in three dimensions. So here you see the cell, the white are the nanoparticle clusters. So you can see them inside the cell in three dimensions, and then we can even go up to extremely high resolution and then get atomic level contrast where you can see the nanoparticles in the cell. In this case, we can see that they actually have diffused into the plasma membrane of the cell, which could be a problem if they damage the membranes. That's where I'll conclude. Anthony's going to follow up now on what the actual impact of these nanoparticles interacting with the cells might be. So I've shown you that they do definitely have some advantage. I think the real advantage in medicine is going to be in these tumour-targeting applications. But their interaction with the cell will be influenced by their size, morphology, and also the surface chemistry of the nanoparticles, which will all affect uptake and biodistributions. So I'll leave it there. What we need to do now is move away from these cellular studies to the whole body, longer-term studies, where we can learn from other applications. For example, an area I've been working, which is hip replacements. So perhaps we could learn a bit from what's happening with wear particle debris formation around an implant, as an example of a whole body human study.
Thank you very much, Alex. I'm sure we'll have plenty of time for questions when we begin our group discussion. I'd now like to invite Professor Anthony Seaton to come down to speak 5 or 10 minutes from his own perspective on these issues.
Thank you. Well, new technology, very important, very impressive possibilities from it. So what happens when something like that comes into being? People go over the top, and they go over the top in two completely separate directions. Some exaggerate the benefits. You've just seen an example of it in the very last slide, saying, am I going to be the first person, last of a generation that dies of cancer? Nobel Prize winners do not have expertise in public health, so take everything they say on public health issues with a big pinch of salt. There is no prospect of nanotechnology eliminating cancer, and if it did, we'd all die of Alzheimer's disease. So let's not go for that. Others exaggerate the risks, and the big exaggeration with nanotechnology was self-replicating particles, grey goo, turning the Earth into grey goo. Prince Charles took that issue up, and it got into all the newspapers. Again, Prince Charles does not have the sort of expertise to comment on these sort of things. So what about the facts? And that's where research comes in. How can we know whether things are harmful when people, because then new technologies, when people have never actually been exposed to them, when the environment has never been exposed to them? Well, fortunately, we can make guesses based on analogy. Nanoparticles are something that we have all been exposed to from the first breath we took, indeed before the first breath we took, because some will undoubtedly get into us when we're in the womb. But the nanoparticles are produced by all combustion processes. So you get them from forest fires, volcanoes, barbecues, that sort of thing. You get them, of course, from urban pollution, from atmospheric pollution all over the world. Millions of nanoparticles you breathe in a city centre every breath you take. So there isn't really a need to be terribly afraid of nanoparticles if we can cope with that. But these new ones, of course, we don't know their toxicity. The analogy we've used comes from two things that we've studied quite intensively. One is a nanoparticle in one dimension, that is asbestos, a naturally occurring mineral, to which many people have been exposed over several hundred years. The other analogy we've used is urban air pollution, and both have taught us a lot about nanoparticles. First of all, carbon nanotubes, one of the perhaps most important developments in nanotechnology with many applications. If you look at carbon nanotubes and you look at asbestos, you see many physical similarities, not chemical, but physical similarities. The trouble is, we know that the harmfulness of asbestos is due primarily to its physical properties. Now, everyone knows asbestos is harmful, but how harmful? Have we got a pointer? I can't seem to get a... Anyway, never mind. This graph behind me shows two sets of curves. The one to your left, the solid blocks, represents importation of asbestos into Britain from 1900, when it first started being used in a big way in Britain. And you can see it rose to a maximum in the 1960s, 70s, and then it declined in the 80s and 90s, and almost, well, none is being imported into Britain now. The curve on the other side, the lines, shows the deaths from a malignant tumour of the lining of the lung known as mesothelioma. Some of you may have heard of it. It's invariably fatal. It's a very unpleasant disease. Indeed, I saw a poor patient suffering from it only 2 days ago. 2,000 people a year in Britain are dying of this disease, and as you follow that curve, you see that the likely mortality is going to remain something between 2,000 and 3,500 over the next 20 or 30 years each year. So it's a serious disease. That's what's known as an epidemic in public health medicine. That's an epidemic of a fatal malignant disease, and it is almost entirely due to asbestos. Well, we want to avoid that, of course, and the purpose of the sort of research that we do is to find out how much of things is dangerous and then find ways of stopping them being dangerous. That is, reducing the risk, understanding the hazard or the likelihood of harm occurring, and then reducing the risk. And we know why asbestos is harmful. It's due to the length of the fibre, which makes them too long to be removed from the lung once they've been inhaled. These cells called macrophages, or big eaters, that crawl around inside our lungs and our bloodstream, get hold of particles and remove them. But asbestos, as you can see on that kebab in front of you, that's a kebab of macrophages. They've all tried to get rid of that fibre and they've failed. And in doing so, they've released cytokines, chemicals that attract other cells and cause inflammation, ultimately cause cancer. So the length, the diameter is important, because finer fibres than 3 microns in diameter, indeed all nanotubes, can be inhaled deep into the lung. Durability is important. If it dissolves in the lung, then it won't cause harm. But of course, carbon nanotubes and other nanotubes are likely to be very durable. That's the purpose of making the things. And then finally, and most importantly, it's a dose that gets into the target organ. And the target organ in the case of asbestos is the lining, the outside lining of the lung. So the particles have got to get in, go through the lung, get to the outside and stick there. And we don't know whether nanotubes can do that. We've recently, however, shown that certain nanotubes conform to this paradigm of the causes of toxicity in fibres, just as other fibres than asbestos do. Long, single, separate nanotubes certainly would have the ability, if they get into the pleura in the lining of the lung in sufficient dose, to cause this malignant disease, mesothelioma. And that was quite recently published. The question is, very important, if you're making nanotubes or using them, do you actually inhale them? And if you inhale them, do they get into the lung and go through the lung? We don't know that. And if they reach the lining of the lung in sufficient numbers. And these are things that we don't want to wait to see, we want to prevent now by regulation. Now, just one last point about nanoparticles other than the fibrous-shaped particles and why there may be concerns about some of them. And I stress not all of them, but we don't know which might be toxic and which may not. Here is an example of a comparison of the same chemical, carbon, in either nano form or fine form. Fine is less than 250 nanometers diameter, and nano is less than 60 nanometers in diameter. And you can see the measure on the y-axis there is a measure of inflammation. So this is a test tube type experiment. And you can see that the same mass of particles causes much more inflammation if they are in the nano form. The same, this seems to be a rather general rule, the same is true of titanium dioxide, which is regarded medically as harmless, but nano titanium dioxide does seem to cause more inflammation than larger particles. And even with such substances as polystyrene latex. And this property of causing inflammation at a smaller size seems to relate to the surface area and in many cases to Fenton reactions occurring on the surface of the particle in the biological medium. But not entirely due to that. Also, size itself seems to be a factor. One little anecdote, a colleague of mine, Professor Vicky Stone, who's a nanotoxicologist, went to her hairdresser and the hairdresser commented that she had a cold. And she said, what you ought to take is nano silver. She didn't know my friend was a nano expert. And Vicky said to her, why do you say that? She said, well, it's great for preventing colds and illnesses. I take it and I give it to my daughter every day. And Vicky looked it up on the web and she found out that you can buy nano silver. Well, she started doing some experiments on nano silver, and to cut a long story short, she showed it was considerably more toxic than silver particles at a larger size range, as you would have expected. But in the same experiment, she looked at cerium oxide, which is used as an additive in petrol, and found that not to be toxic in the same way. So some are potentially toxic, some seem not to be. And that's a big problem because there's so many of these things and we need to find out which are likely to do harm and which are not. And that's something, I think, for discussion. So that's all I'm going to say now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Dr. John Roberts, who is from DEFRA, the Government Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. And is the head of chemicals and nanotechnologies, I believe.
Well, good evening, and thank you very much for your invitation to come tonight and to speak at this debate, which, if I may say so, I think is very timely. I don't know how many people will have seen it in the press yesterday, but the Royal Commission on Environmental Pollution published a report on the regulation of nanotechnology on Tuesday, and it was very interesting to see the way that that was covered in the different newspapers. I think you might have got a slightly different impression of the issues according to which newspaper you read, but anyway, it's certainly topical. Now, I want to speak on the question of the regulation of nanomaterials and what the government needs to do in response to some of the challenges which Alex and Anthony have referred to. Just to qualify terms, I want to talk primarily about nanoparticles. I mean, nanotechnology can mean anything small, but that can be just small in terms of a nano iPod, for example, which uses very small components in it. But it's the free nanoparticles that we're worried about in terms of the potential impact on health or the environment. Things which are either nano-sized in three dimensions, particles, or perhaps nano-sized in one or two dimensions if they're free, like the long-chain carbon nanotubes that have been referred to. Of course, in some ways, these aren't new. People have been making nanomaterials for many years. Medieval stained glass is red because of nano gold mixed into the glass. And things like Hollandaise sauce or certain types of cheese are, at one level of definition, man-made nanoparticles. But that's not really where the main concern is. It's over the newer substances which are being introduced for their new properties. As has been indicated, there are enormous potential benefits from nanomaterials, both from medicine, fuel cells, batteries. Anything which depends on surface area is likely to be relevant in the nano field. So energy storage devices, where the energy is stored on a surface, likely to be more efficient, very important in terms of climate change. In some countries, they use nano iron to remediate contaminated soil. Not something we do in this country, but if it's proved to be safe, then it has potentially enormous benefits. But equally, as has been indicated, there are risks. Because nanoparticles have new properties, they may have new modes of action, and they may be more toxic in the nano form than in the bulk form. So we need to decide how to regulate. And the aim is to protect both human health and also ecosystems, because we depend crucially on ecosystems, so we must be concerned about those impacts as well. And the big challenge here is that innovation is going ahead very rapidly, and the question of can regulation keep up with innovation, given that in many areas, for reasons I'll explain at the moment, the science may not yet be in the position to tell us the regulatory answers that we need. What should we be controlling and what is safe to use? And there are different approaches you can adopt to this. One approach is to say, well, we'll allow everything on the market until we get positive evidence that it's dangerous. So a fairly optimistic approach. At the other extreme, you can say we won't allow anything on the market until we've actually done all the testing and are absolutely sure that it's safe. And both those two extremes actually have problems, because if you say everything's got to be proved safe, first of all, you can never actually prove things are safe, but also you just kill off innovation and you don't actually get any new developments coming forward if the hurdle is too high. If you go to the other end, you're probably too relaxed and we'll run into problems. The history of chemical regulation is full of chemicals which proved to be a fantastic idea when they were invented, only to discover sometime later that in fact there were major problems. Asbestos was regarded as an absolutely magnificent material for heat insulation and fire prevention until it turned out to be dangerous. PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, absolutely tremendous at insulation for use in transformers. It just turns out that because they are so stable, they're very persistent, and they can have dioxin-like effects and are very cause big problems for nature. Freons, absolutely great for refrigerants. It's just that they destroy the ozone layer. And with most of those things, we found out about the problem perhaps a generation after we did the initial development. So really the challenge for nano is to try and get the science and the regulation developing, well, in parallel would be ideal, but hopefully very close behind if we can't achieve absolutely in parallel the innovation. Most of the experts who've looked at this area, the Royal Society 3 or 4 years ago and the Royal Commission, have said there isn't a case for having a blanket moratorium on the development of nanomaterials. But they have said that we need to move very fast to get the science in place and have the regulatory systems around nano to make sure that we can deal with them. But there are quite a few challenges in getting the regulation right. With chemicals, over 100 years or so, we understand reasonably well the mechanisms by which chemicals are going to cause problems. Apart from the ones that are acutely toxic, the ones that come onto the market that we're concerned about are those which, in the language of regulators, they're either CMR, they're either carcinogenic, mutagenic, or toxic to reproduction, which is one class. And if a chemical fails on any of those three criteria, then we have concerns about it. Or chemicals which are persistent and bioaccumulative and toxic, which means that once they get into the environment, they're going to be there for a long time. If they're bioaccumulative, they'll move up through the food chain and then if they're toxic, they will harm the predators at the top of the food chain. So things like DDT, for example, are PBT in the language. They rise up the food chain. And we've got pretty well established tests that we can use to assess chemicals against those criteria. So there are something like 100,000 chemicals on the market in Europe. They're being systematically put through tests to see whether they're CMR or they're PBT. The challenge with nano is that there will be new modes of action. Nano materials can get into places that other materials don't get. So there are possibilities there that we may not yet understand. We're moving from a field with regular chemicals where, if you'll excuse a Rumsfeld phrase, we know what we don't know, into nanomaterials where the challenge is much more currently we're not quite sure what we don't know. So there's a great deal more uncertainty around these things. So what we've been doing is trying to put in place across government a research programme to tackle five issues. First of all, how do you measure and detect nanoparticles? Because one of the key problems is they're not always produced to reproducible standards. So you may get a test result that comes out of one lab that may not be replicated in another lab. So we actually need standard definitions, standard samples and replicable results. Then we need to understand the human toxicology, which involves both looking at the classical things we understand and also being on the lookout for new modes of action. Are nanoparticles crossing the blood-brain barrier, for example, or the placental barrier? And if so, where do they get to? Next, we need to understand the environmental transport and fate of nanomaterials. So if nanosilver, for example, leaches out of your nano-impregnated socks and goes into the washing machine, what happens to it in the environment? Does it turn up in the water supply? Does it turn up in the sewage works? What impact does it have there? Then we need to understand the ecotoxicological consequences of nanoparticles. What effect does it have on ecosystems? Are they toxic to fish? Do they affect bacteria? Do they affect plants? And then finally, we need to understand the social and ethical implications and how the public understand these things and what the general political consensus is about how they should be regulated. So we've put in place that work. It's a fairly large agenda that we have, and we're trying to make progress on it. We're working internationally, so we're working very much with the OECD countries in order to share out the burden. And in that group, we have identified the 14 nanoparticles which we think are most commonly encountered. And different groups of countries are attempting to prepare full dossiers on the toxicology and environmental impact, both to look at those particles in detail, but also to come up with more standardised test methods so that when we understand how to do it with those particles, then it can be rolled out much more quickly to look at new particles. In the UK, with colleagues from the US, we're looking particularly at nano cerium oxide, which Anthony referred to, and also zinc oxide, which is used in sun cream. And we've managed to put forward a work programme, which we're now just kicking off, which will take the next couple of years. There's a lot more I could say about the legal aspects of regulation, about how this is being approached in Europe, how we're seeking to adapt the REACH regulation that applies to chemicals, how HSE are responding to the issues on carbon nanotubes that have been referred to. But perhaps it would be best to get into some of those issues during the debate later in the meeting. So I shall look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our final speaker is Professor Chapman, Professor at Sibley University.
Right, well, good evening, and thank you to the Chemistry Society for inviting me. Nowadays, science and technology has become so specialised, so finely focused, that there's a danger of losing context. To give you an obvious example, how long have we known that burning fossil fuels gives rise to carbon dioxide, which will accumulate in the atmosphere and will put up the temperature? of the atmosphere. Well, I mean, that's not even O-level chemistry, is it, or physics? It's blindingly obvious. But it hasn't actually stopped us from damaging the atmosphere and putting us in a globally critical situation. What this tells us is that the scientific and technological view, perhaps it's not widely enough known, perhaps there's something wrong with our educational system, but it also tells us that our social, political, ethical, cultural relations leave a lot to be desired. And they are the things that are actually in the way of our making beneficial use of technology for the human race as a whole. So people like me, generally a bit of a pain, because we turn up at conferences trying to put context into what are often very refined and technical discussions. I mean, a week before last, I was speaking at the National Physical Laboratory to about 100 metrologists, and I was very aware that if any of them had spoken to me about metrology, I probably wouldn't have known what they were talking about. And yet I think they did find some benefit and usefulness in what I was saying. So let's look at the big picture. I'm a big picture person. I'm interested in technology policy for the human race and priorities. I'm interested in the social and economic impacts of technology. I'm interested in risk management. I'm interested in public engagement with technology and so on. Now, there's a lot that could be said, of course, and I'm going to try and reduce it to two just major perspectives. One is good and one is bad. Or to put it in another way, let's look at the issue of benefits and how what are the ethics of benefits, which really boils down to the question of what should be the priorities for nanotechnology in the 21st century if we take a global view. What should be the priorities? Should it be skin cream, go faster, skis, tennis rackets, and so on, which is where a lot of the investment and development is going on, or should it be in some other areas, which I'm going to now suggest in a moment. Then there's the ethics of harm, and how do we approach the possible harms which will result from nanotechnologies. We've had controversies around genetically modified organisms, around nuclear energy, and so on. The world has changed. The ordinary public know a lot more than they used to about science and technology. Still not very much, but they know a lot more. And also, they are more challenging. So you can't just introduce a technology, hide it from people, and then expect them to accept it, because they won't. So, what are the ethics of the possible harms? So, part one, ethics of benefit. This is going to be, I know this looks as though this is going to be a very long lecture, but I'm going to whiz through it. First of all, let's take the benefits side. Now, my premise here is very simple. If we were to take a global view and look at the crises that are converging on us, financial and economic, energy, climate change, this is a very nasty situation for us to be in. We have to change our ways of thinking, and we have to cooperate. And we have to get our priorities right, and it doesn't look as though the market is going to sort it out for us. There has to be massive public direct investment in technologies, amongst other things, to get us out of this hole. What can nanotechnology do? Well, let's look at that in global terms. One, pollution prevention. None of this is meant to exclude other possibilities, but these are some of the things that nanotechnology can do in addition to some of the other technologies. Molecular sensing of pollutants, acidity in chemicals, chemical agents in soil, water, and so on. Ultraviolet light, catalysis for treatment of contaminants, purification of water without the use of chlorine, nanoporous ceramic has been invented to absorb waste mercury, just to give an example. I'll race through these rather quickly, but you're welcome to have the printout of these slides if you want to look at it more carefully and follow it up. Secondly, recycling and remediation. Remediation, that word remediation comes from remedy, to put things right when the previous technology has caused problems for us. We've already heard about PCBs, asbestos and so on, nuclear waste, lots and lots of problems caused by previous technologies. Can we use this technology to put some of that right? Well, quite possibly, but we have to focus. We have to focus our efforts and our finance on these issues and stop fiddling about with skis that can go faster or nano polish to put on our cars. There's a list, absorbents and adsorbents for remediation of water and other media, oil-water separation, pollution of the sea by oil tankers and so on. It's always a problem. It's not going to be a problem for very much longer because we won't have oil tankers wandering about the oceans. Iron nanoparticles coated with palladium being developed to break down organochlorines in groundwater. Spillage responses, super paramagnetic nanoparticles designed to bind to any molecular targets and then magnetize to remove from the medium. There's a lot of work going on in that area. The theme here is obviously how do we shift to a sustainable global economy, one which has been described as cyclic, rather than open-ended economic growth. Well, here is something that nanotechnology can do for us. It can reduce our energy inputs, and God knows we need to do that. Driving around in huge lumps of metal is hardly efficient. We can produce all sorts of nanocomposites, which are very, very strong, very, very lightweight. That will certainly reduce the energy inputs required to move machinery, transport devices, aeroplanes, anything you like. I read that the Japanese have developed a steel containing carbon nanotubes, which is 6 times lighter than standard steel, but about 100 times stronger. Now, just imagine that, and what that can do for moving towards lightweight materials and all sorts of uses in which we can reduce the energy inputs required for the moving parts. Intelligent products, which could be very useful in many ways from a sustainability point of view. For example, tracking of products for liability for recycling. When people dump things in various places, very often we can't really find out who did what where, which makes it very difficult to implement legislation to stop pollution. But we could use nano labeling to find out who dumped this where. Where was it made? Who's responsible for it? And so on. Surfaces that need less cleaning. This is already happening with nano silver, which I know is problematic from a toxicological point of view. But it really depends on how we use it and how we dispose of it and so on. Do we need, just look in the average household under the sink, and look at the range of cleaning materials. You know, I tell my wife off sometimes. She's probably got 20 different brand products there. You know, one for the surfaces, one for the glass, and, you know, one for keeping the polish on the taps and so on. Do we really need such a wide range if we can produce surfaces which are self-cleaning? That would cut down pollution, surely. Manufacturing efficiency. This is where I think there are huge opportunities, and Professor Roland Clift at my university is behind a new movement called industrial ecology, in which we could use nanotechnology and other technologies to make our industry much more efficient, both in terms of the energy and the materials going as inputs, and in terms of a reduction in the waste and in the toxicity of that waste. So we could have a hyper efficient industrial system sometime in the future, but only if, instead of leaving things to the market, we actually focus on these technologies and get governments, regional governments, or even a new UN body or whatever, to focus on these developments, because large investments are required. In the present climate, people are hardly investing in anything, as you will have noticed if you've been following the news. So, efficiency, reduction of material resources, inputs, and so on. Finally, alternative energy production, which has already been mentioned. A whole range of things that can be done with nanotechnology there. And oil, coal, will soon be things of the past. We have to move and move much more quickly to alternative energy sources. Nanotechnology is not the only solution, but it's got some solutions. We need young people like yourselves saying, yes, that's where I want to do my chemistry and physics, in new sustainable technologies and alternative energy. There's just one little example of molybdenum disulfide nanocrystals used as catalysts to remove sulfur impurities at oil refineries, which reduces the sulfur emissions. I haven't followed that up. I don't know how far that's going, but there are lots and lots of ideas there if you look at the literature. So, harm. I just want to say something about the precautionary principle. Now, one could give a whole lecture about this, and it's been already referred to. What is the precautionary principle? Well, you've got to contrast it with something. I call it the evidentiary principle. The evidentiary principle is that if there is no scientific evidence that something causes harm, then just go ahead. So that was the principle on which we said there is no evidence that BSE and CJD are connected. So we had a minister of agriculture, wasn't it, who was stuffing hamburgers into his daughter's mouth on television and saying, you know, there is no evidence that. That's the evidentiary principle, or at least I call it that. Now, we've got to turn that on its head as a general orientation or attitude, if you like. So instead of saying, you know, that the citizens or consumers should provide evidence that there's a risk, the corporations and so on should show us that it's safe within reasonable grounds, with various exceptions and so on. If we're talking about general orientation here, and with any general orientation, there will be all sorts of special circumstances and so on. So, for example, on a general orientation, when somebody comes into a hospital unconscious, we assume that they want to live. We don't assume that they want to die. We assume they want to live. But we might be wrong. Maybe they've just been trying to kill themselves. Well, who knows? So this is, you know, precautionary principles has to be fleshed out in detail. It's only a change in orientation. There's a statement of it. The classic statement, which I had to read three times before I could make sense of it. It's a little bit obscure. But the best way to think of it is as a shift in burden of proof or onus from the consumers to the manufacturers. That's what simple way of looking at it. It's a diagram I use in my classes to explain the difference between the precautionary principle and the evidentiary one. Based on if you have some sort of early warning, but it has to be an adequate early warning of some kind. I know there are problems around that. To say, well, we've got some early warnings. We ought to be careful here. Let's do more research, either before or at the same time, as we develop a particular application. And then we won't get into the trouble that we did with asbestos or PCBs, the other things that have been referred to. And what does that mean, fleshing all that out? Well, there's a whole list of things. I won't plod through these now, but there's no point in talking about the precautionary principle as though it, in itself it would solve all our problems, because it's only a general orientation. It's got to be fleshed out in terms of what follows from that once you accept it, which is what the European Union has done. The European Commission has said, this is the principle that we ought to be following and that industry ought to be following. You are strongly recommended to adopt the precautionary principle. And that should bring about a sea change over our regulations and laws. Of course, there's going to be a lot of resistance to that. Why would you think that would be? Well, who's going to pay for the early stage or upstreamed research? The corporations? I don't think so. That's putting an extra burden of cost on them. So that's where part of the problem comes, industrial resistance to this shift. So we've got to think about how is that going to be financed. Here, again, I won't plow through this, and perhaps we could have a bit of this in the discussion, but here are some of the specific cases where this principle is applicable. And I think, if you look at this and you keep in mind what the other speakers have said, you will see that this applies to nanotechnology on the whole. Now, when we talk about nanotechnology, we're not actually talking about a single technology. We're talking about a change that goes right across science and technology. Because all of science, all of technology is coming down to the nanoscale. And at that point, it's converging, because it's just the manipulation of matter at the nanoscale. So there's no one thing called nanotechnology. The reason that we're interested in it is because novel properties appear below about 300 nanometers. But common sense tells us if they're novel properties, why by some miracle will they only be beneficial ones? Of course they're not going to be. There's going to be a mixture of benefits and new risks. And the danger is this. If you forget everything else, this is the danger of treating as familiar what is unfamiliar. Because if you take a familiar substance with decades of research behind it, such as titanium, zinc, iron, whatever, right? Familiar, well understood, take it down to the nanoscale, the properties change. Should we be treating the nanoscale zinc as though it were that familiar zinc we've been dealing with for decades? I think the answer is no. But that is what is going on. And that is why there is no regulatory regime anywhere in the world which is treating nanoscale versions of familiar substances as new materials. It's recognized that they're new, but at the same time, it's not regulating them as though they were new. That's not to say that all nanoscale materials are dangerous. Of course they're not. We just need to know which ones are and which ones are not. So lots of recommendations for business. Top 10 companies, if you're interested in nanotechnology, BASF, Boeing, DuPont, IBM, etc., etc. I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.